Blog Talk Radio.
Morning, everybody. It's September 25th. Nazarita Goldhammer is on the show. Kevin Boyle is on the show. That's me. We're here again discussing the interrelational self and human intimacy with nature. This is a paramount topic. We've created systems that have ended up in moral catastrophe against humans, against animals, the land, and we continue to do it. I want to read a little bit today. In 1896, Frank Wilson Blackmore, he says, the domestication of animals led to a great improvement in the race. It gave an increased food supply through milk and the flesh of animals. And one after another, animals have rendered service to man, used for food or clothing or to carry burdens and draw loads. The advantage of their domestication cannot be too greatly estimated. The Harvard professor of paleontology, Nathaniel Southgate Shaler, in the group of continents termed the Old World, there were many species of large mammals which were well fitted for domestication. The advance of social development went on rapidly. There are a lot of writers that wrote in the late 1800s about how we somehow left the brutish, barbaric state of life by domesticating animals. And so if you talk to just about anybody, they'll take it to be a natural and normal thing that we have subjugated. And when I mean subjugation, I don't mean a peaceful coexistence necessarily. I mean heinous subjugation, where we take away everything that's normal and natural for another being, and we make them do our bidding. And people accept that. People just accept it, that that's the way it is, somehow it's right to do. And so when we're grown, we're inculcated with these beliefs, we go to school. So just think about all of the farm animals we subjugate: cows, pigs, chickens, sheep, horses, goats. And part of the other vector, I think, that comes into this is the violence of scarcity. No matter what some people might say, we do live within a scarcity of resources. And it's a technical definition, and it means that there are not unlimited resources, and that's just a fact, and we just have to accept it. What we do with that is a different matter. And so you have people fighting each other over resources. That's always been the case. Just taking and killing other people. When the Western United States was settled, there was an intense amount of bloodshed. So, but in this process of so-called progress and civilization or civilizing, animals who are sentient beings were treated as non-sentient. They've been treated as things. They've been treated like apples and oranges. Apples and oranges aren't sentient. They're just not. Again, if you believe that, then you also believe in the Tooth Fairy and the Easter Bunny. Apples and oranges aren't sentient. They're products. But animals have sentience. They have feelings. They have life aims. They have values. They have culture. And so here we are over and over. Probably the animals that have been most subjugated have been cows, dairy cows, and beef cattle. And we continue to clear land to produce more because people want to eat flesh. And so there, you can't separate. This is important for people who want to do work in this area. You can't separate racism from speciesism or sexism from speciesism. I had to think about it for many years, and I finally figured out that they all go together. They're different facets of the same problem, power. And so you have people of certain ethnic backgrounds being forced into slavery or low-paying jobs, hard work. You have children who have been abused in the work system, in capitalism. You have women who have been subjugated to work, to work, you know, 20 hours a day in some cases. So who took most of the cattle, the meat, the milk, and the hides? Who did that? It wasn't everybody. It was the few. What we did, and the thing is, we didn't, it was a twofold manipulation. One, we didn't own those animals, but we acted as if we did. So we went, we took them. There was no payment. In fact, and there was no payment back to the ecosystems either for water that we might pollute or forests that we might destroy. There was a taking and no giving. And then the second piece of this is how the very small group of people figured out a way to subjugate most of the people and pay them lowly, high subsistence wages. And so there's this clever... and I'm gonna just kind of hand off the torch, Nasrita, to you in just a second. So there's been this sleight of hand with language where animals from the forest are harvested. It's viewed that they're harvested. They're part of nature's bounty. A very Christian, very Catholic notion. They're part of the biota. There's no such thing as like an individual animal. They're all just part of a species that need to be managed, subjugated, the same as the forest and the water. So the sleight of hand is in language. And so once you start calling a being just a member of a species of in nature, then you can do all kinds of things to them. And now the upshot of that is that we grossly torture and harm farmed animals. And in fact, farmed animal research is even worse. It is disgusting. It is so gross it'll make you throw up. What we do to animals in called farmed animal research. And the U.S. government pays for that research. And you pay for that with your taxes. They do heinous things to try to increase meat production. That's all it's about. So here we are. Okay, so I think we're having some technical difficulties. I'm not seeing Nasrita on the call. And, but that's okay. When I grew up, we really were taught that the farmed animals were, of a different, a more lowly value status. A value status that was different. They were food. Or, game animals, people like their hides and their horns. Or the, you know, the domestication of dairy cows. So I worked for a dairy once upon a time. And the fact of the matter is those beings were, they were robbed of most of anything that, that they would have experienced naturally. And so there's a values issue, an ethics issue. You know, what is the nature of a being? And human rights are based on this. If you look at all treatises about human rights, constitutions, bills of rights. There are all kinds of articulations about the rights of people. And they so the way you get at that is you start thinking about, well, what is the definition of a person? What do they do? What do they hold dear? What is good? What do they pursue? And these things are really important. And that's why if you look at the criminal law and civil law in the United States, you end up seeing these values of what a person has come to light. Now, that doesn't take away from the critique that capitalism determines the distribution of these rights. But at least theoretically, there's a set of rights. Well, animals don't have that. And so here we are in our inner relational being with water and forests and animals, is that they are here for our pleasure, our amusement, our aggression, our rage, our violence, our food. That somehow we have this right. And people have been indoctrinated into this originally from the Christian faith, the Christianity. And so, yes, there have been small exceptions where some people would talk about mercy, or that if you're kind to an animal, you'd be more likely to be kind to human. So it's still humanist-based. Most people don't get that. There's no provision for an animal right that an animal had, a non-human animal had, just as much of a value as a human, and just as much right to be here and to be left alone and to be respected in his or her existence in their own nature. And that's why it's such a beautiful quest, I think, to think about the nature of a being. What is the nature of the grizzly bear? The nature of the wolf, the nature of a human being. They're lovely questions, because when you start thinking about those and concretely studying a crow, for example, and really watching and listening to their life, the intrinsic beauty of their life, then you start to see that humans largely have a skewed vision, that we have a highly instrumentalized value system when it comes to other beings. So why is that dangerous? It's dangerous because if you develop a moral dynamic in which might makes right, or the more powerful can subjugate the less powerful, or the smarter can subjugate the less smarter, then that flows through every human to some degree. It's in there somewhere, if that's our value that we've developed over the millennia. And so you see that come out in iterations of racism, sexism, ageism, discrimination against children and discrimination against the elderly, or discrimination against the disabled, so-called disabled. In some ways, some disabled are a lot more special than any average random human being. So you have this dynamic, and it's a prime example is Nazism, the Nazis, who basically got a lot of Jewish people to believe that they deserve to die. Not all, but many. And that this would be called the death of grace or a graceful death. That this would be that we were going to kill you and this is the easiest way for you to die. And there were others, of course, who didn't want to die. But there's actually this perpetration of a deep cultural belief that some people should die for eugenics. And there's always somebody trying for eugenics. Even now, Mark Zuckerberg and his lovely MD wife are making big claims that they can eradicate all disease in humans. And what it smells like to me is another iteration of eugenics movement. There's no way that's going to happen for everybody. And number one, they didn't talk about any distributional justice issues. And number two, absolutely no inclusion of non-human species in those grandiose statements. Nazarita, welcome to the show. We're talking about dominion and subjugation of non-human animals because we're trying to tie this whole millennia of belief about the value of non-humans and what sort of a relationship we can have with them and how that affects our relationship to ourselves and to other humans. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. I was really taken by what you read, the quote that you read in the very beginning. Because last week we were talking about solastalgia, where we're longing for a place that no longer exists. And I think a lot of marketing nowadays in terms of consumption of meat, toys that we feel are necessary to our lives, houses, boats, cruises, having more and more, is linked to something that we're missing, that we think that maybe in the past was there and led to this perfect life. And when you read that, I just thought, this is how meat is marketed, with little happy cows on the package, happy bison, which make people think, wow, this is just such a beautiful union with nature. And I think this is where humans are always wanting two things. They either want to go back or they want to go forward, but they don't want to really look at what is present. And marketing is meant for you, is carries with it these two strong components. It's either the nostalgia for something that was simpler, or that you could eat all the meat you wanted, or where cows were happy and chickens were happy and sheep were happy, and you could go kill deer and you can have meat in your freezer and you could live just a really happy, lovely life and not even think about what you've killed, and that the animals were there only for our pleasure, and if we killed them, we would thank them later for giving them their long life to us so that we could eat our 10-minute meal. And that's really the reality of it. And then the future is, eat all you want. It's here anyway. It's packaged. It's ready to go. It will go to waste. If we don't eat it, it's going to go to waste. And this is just this marketing cultural ploy to put us in a position where we cannot think for ourselves. And it always leads to dominion. I mean, there are places still, so many places in the United States where bigotry is rampant. It isn't just against Jews. It's against Asians. It's against Blacks. It's like this total force in the United States that is totally against each other. It's this violence to say the other is so different than me that they don't deserve or have value or deserve to live. And we see that in our housing market, in the job market. There was once a study a while ago, and what they, two things. One was with houses. A lot of Black Americans, when they listed their house for sale, they were appraised at very low, and they got very low bids. And yet, when they put their name as white, a white name, then it was appraised higher. And people actually wanted to buy it for the higher price. And then in jobs, if you had an odd-sounding name, you would be passed by for interviews because it was like, oh, yeah, these are foreigners. These do not have white, simple names. These are foreign names, and therefore would be passed up. So a lot of people ended up putting, you know, a simplified name instead of what their real names were in order to even get a job interview. And this works the same way with clothing, with the way that we wear our hair. I mean, a lot of people with different kind of hair than straight are fired because they can't wear their hair the way that some white overlord wants them to wear it. And so I look at all these things and I think we're caught in such a cultural harness that for us to get out is difficult. And we have to strive every day to look at what is the reality of what we're doing? What is that dominance? And you can look around, and it doesn't matter who you are. There is dominance at play where somehow there is someone that you think is less. And there was this vegan art that was on Facebook that is just really so humorous and so sad. It's a white woman, a Karen, wearing a sweatshirt, and says, "I heart animals." And in her cart is hamburger and beef and steak and bacon and all the things that are animals, but her mind is only on the dog that she loves, but her all the animals that were killed for her to have her little bit of lunch or dinner or snack are in her cart dead because of what she chose. And I think that this is really the heart. Like, what are we choosing? How are we going to choose? We're in a huge climate crisis. And yet, to be really honest, I don't see a lot of movement of people actually choosing different than what led us into this crisis. Like, there's all these stories that pop up, news stories, warning us. But, you know, we're going way past 1.5 now, warming. And yet everybody's like, yeah, well, you know, it doesn't seem bad right now. It's okay, you know, got a little cold, got a little heat. It seems all right. And so I think that's the consciousness that we're looking at. And eugenics is a really important part of our history that has been repeated again and again. And yet we keep saying again and again that we won't let it be repeated, and yet we keep repeating it again and again. And so I always think, what is it that causes us to keep repeating the same mistakes, expecting a different result than what we're getting? Like, what are we expecting? The earth is just going to miraculously turn around and animals are going to come to life and there's going to be plenty. You know, that's what we're going to do. I think I'm not understanding the mindset that is in that. And you and I have talked about this, like wells in India, where the backyard, one person drills a well to get more water. The others see it. They drill 50 wells. Everybody drills 100 wells, as many wells as they can. Pretty soon there's no water. But that's the mindset that I feel like we're in. We're in that clearance sale of the earth. Get what you can now because it won't be there later. Is that kind of what you're seeing too?
Well, yeah, obviously there's fear and anxiety build on themselves. But let's go back to the language issue. So we're talking about animals and we're talking about forests. We're talking about water. I'll give our listeners some examples. So one distinction for dogs is between a working dog and a pet. And if you call a dog a working dog, that means it's okay to abuse them because it's not really abuse. You see how that works. Working dogs are kept outside under horrible conditions. They're isolated. They go crazy. It's absolutely horrible. Or farmed animals. The whole idea of a farmed animal is a social construction. That's not what they are. They're beings. They have very well defined neural frameworks, nerve systems. They have emotions. They have social bonds. They can suffer. I mean, that's describing humans. And yet we call somebody a farmed animal, and that means we try to pretend that those things are not present. Just like pigs have gotten a bad name. Pigs are very smart and loving and kind. But if we say they're not, if we pretend that they're not capable of suffering, then we can do anything we want to them. Water. People don't understand the beauty of mountain springs and mountain streams and lakes and rivers. I mean, if you start talking about them that way, the beauty and all the life that is a part of those water ecosystems, and you start thinking about water as something that comes in a bottle, you know, from one of these large companies that bottles them, there's two different things. A bottle of water is not the same as a mountain spring. They're two different things. Or you take a forest, beautiful forest. It's a biosphere, all the life that's in it. And if you run a construction company and you want to go out and get some lumber, to you, the forest is only board feet of lumber. And so these are all, in my view, these language transformations are violent acts. They are violent by their very nature. They're violent by their very nature because they distort the reality of the being who is affected. You can say all sorts of false things about people from various skin colors and ethnic backgrounds and races, or people do it with gender. And once you start saying those words, they become sedimented, and they give you power. They're related to power. Words create power. They create power morally, and they create power legally. So right now, many of us are still grieving because Lolita, the orca, kidnapped as a baby, forced into enslaved labor to make money, and she eventually died in the Miami Seaquarium. And who is left in that Seaquarium right now? Most people don't know this. That Seaquarium houses a little dolphin. His name is Lil. There's a dolphin floating around, unused, private, quiet, completely meaningless existence that this dolphin now swims in. Dolphins are extraordinarily social. They're like crows. And yet, because of the decisions of the owners, this poor little dolphin is probably psychotic. And you can almost bet they're going to find a way to make this dolphin sick, and it will die. Or you have, here's another one. And these are all nihilisms. These are all from nihilisms. We have federal endangered species protection for the gray wolf, but we have exceptions. We admit that they're endangered, and they're at risk of being extinct. And so we put them on a federal protection, but we have exceptions. And the exceptions are starting to swallow up the rule. I mean, there are tens of thousands of examples like this. You can't, there are laws, in fact, there are laws in California, this is my last example, there are laws in California that say that you can rescue an animal who's hurt or sick or ill. And yet you can't do it in a factory farm factory. A factory farm prison. You can't do that because it's somebody's property. So what's happening is that you have these floating value words that actually mean something, but they don't have any force and effect. And therefore they don't mean anything. Now that's a really hard concept to get. They carry a latent meaning, but because the meaning has no efficacy, it becomes a non-meaning. So I call it ghost meaning or an abject meaning. It's false. False meaning. Abject meaning. Like drawing a line through a word. It's an erasure. So I don't know if that answers your question, Nazarita. Just don't know.
Yeah, it does. I think that's really interesting. We're used to certain types of entertainment. And, you know, those types of entertainment mean that people are excited to go to something, even if it's connected with cruel intentions or violence, one of which is the zoo, water parks. They're also hideously violent toward that which they capture, which is orcas and whales and meaning to perform, you know, gorillas in encaged places of which, you know, there's always these posts which show a gorilla coming up to the window looking at a mother and her baby, wanting to see the baby. And I think, you know, the sentiment of these videos is like, oh, look, the gorilla loves the little baby. But really, really what it is the gorilla is saying, I had a family. I want my family back. I'm in a cage. I'm in this little tiny place that I don't have free to roam. I can't be myself. And yet humans' interpretation of language is also at play. Like when they hear the word, let's go see the gorillas, you know, or let's go see, you know, all these animals that are told through marketing that we are able to see them and they are preserving the species. They're preserving it. For what? I mean, what? So that the place where they are can earn more money. That's really why they're preserving the species. Let's get someone that's almost extinct. Let's put them in the zoo. Let's charge money to see them. And let's forcibly impregnate them and see if they can carry any babies so that we can make more money from people coming to the zoo to see them. And therefore, but we can say that this is what's going on. I think what really hit me once was the Iditarod. Someone posted that I knew that they had gone to see the Iditarod in Nome, Alaska. And they were really excited, and they said they were taken on a personal tour, and they saw the dogs, and they said, here's what they said. The dogs were so excited to work. They wanted to work. That's what they live for. And I'm thinking, okay, where is the critical thinking in this? They're starved unless they pull the sled. That's it. And so, yes, they want to pull the sled because then they're going to get fed. Are they treated well? No. Do they want to do that work? No. It's like, does an elephant want to carry trees through the forest chained so that someone could get wood? Does an elephant want to do those things? No. Why do we think that all of the animals in the earth are here to just do our bidding, like to help us in some way? Like, oh, yeah, you're here for that. Oh, there's a horse. That is for me to ride and me to use. There's a donkey to carry my stuff. There's an elephant to perform for my entertainment. There's a gorilla that I can go see and just check him out and throw things out of cage to see if he responds. I mean, are we really that ignorant? And every day there are new things coming out that animals have feelings. And I'm thinking, are we really idiots that we didn't know that? That when we see that, you know, other animals have lives and want to be with people that they love and want to have, you know, families, are we that ignorant and obtuse that we don't see that in others? I just don't understand.
Right. And Again, I want to highlight this parallelism or isomorphism between exploitation of animals and exploitation of humans. It's a way of thinking about, at the most basic existential level, we have, gosh, I almost feel embarrassed to say this, we're full of fear and anxiety. At a deep, deep, deep level, humans are, in my view, ontologically insecure. And so if you don't behave philosophically and thinkingly, you end up behaving through power. And so think about these words and how they apply to both animals and many humans. Invasion. Conquest. Extermination. Displacement. Repression. Slavery. Gender subordination. Sexual exploitation. Hunger. Thirst. The fear that somebody's going to come and take you away. And so animals have to live with this every single day. And there are many people who will find all kinds of mendacious ways of re-articulating the situation of the animal. There have been really specious arguments that because we're stronger and smarter, we have more rights. Some silliness like that. But if you start creating the system of a disparity, in other words, where you live in this world competitively and you live in this world out of fear and anxiety, and you get to possess things and maybe a law protects that, and then you have kinship ties and tribal ties, and maybe even small group ties, and you go out into the world, and so it's war. It's war whether you're using a gun or whether you're some cheap, fearful Wall Street trader. I mean, these people are bozos. What they're doing, they're parasites. They have one objective, and that's to make more money. That's it. Other values don't matter. As long as they can get away with it, they'll do anything to make more money. And there's lots of little snotty kids who go to elite New England schools so they can become Wall Street traders, Wall Street lawyers, Wall Street traders, investment bankers. But these are the people who are making money off of the servitude of animals and the servitude of many, if not most, humans. And everybody believes that this is the way things have to be. Most people do. Most people believe this is the way things are. So how does that affect the interrelational self? Well, it creates violence. This is the thing. It creates a lot of violence. I mean, what is violence? Something Nazarita that I was considering the other day was how difficult it is for people to change their thinking or their behavior. Any of us could take a small behavior that we have that we want to change. We all have them. It could be small, but we don't. We could. Some of us do. And then we realize that it was actually easy to do. You just have to will it. And it happens. But we don't change any of this exploitation. Which I find very interesting. And then we have this incessant desire to rationalize, ratiocinate, ruminate, cogitate, so-called think, reflect. And in my wise old age, I've realized that a lot of that thinking really just serves power. That the people don't, there's an instrumentalized interpretation of thinking. But really deep, creative, wonderful, profound thinking has its own intrinsic. The thinking of the modern physicist from the Enlightenment forward, it came from a certain way of thinking about being. People don't want to get that. They don't even want to look at that. The kind of mathematics that we created, it's not just one mathematics, but the way we've interpreted being created a kind of thinking about the cosmos, which created a kind of physics and a kind of mathematics, and we instrumentalize everything. And now we've all become inebriated with cause and effect explanation and statistical reasoning. And check this out. So this can be articulated in many different ways. And this is why most levels of critique are worthless. When you have most arguments, most data, most citationable articles, more or less are applauded based upon background assumptions. So if they fall in line with the background assumption, then they're valued. And even if they make a small change, as long as they don't offend the background assumptions, then there's a lot of just trash academic literature that's got good for nothing. And the same with science, because it's controlled and colonized by power. And so everybody reading, all the scholars reading a particular article will say, oh, this is great. Well, this is just great, because what it does is it just feeds. That's the aha moment. What people don't realize is the aha moment is not aha about anything. It's not enlightenment. It's not insight. It's not wisdom. It's not. What it is, it's a repetition, so that you get to feel good about your way of understanding the world. That's not real thinking. And so right now we have this deep background assumptions that it's okay to use others, and it's okay to compete. And capitalism is great. And so when we talk about the interrelational self and human intimacy, we have all these arguments by tradition, arguments by authority. And we all need to take a look at those. Every one of us does. We need to be skeptical. We need to take the opposing position. We need to think about it. Now, we're out of time. Thank you, Nazarita. Thank you to me. Thanks to all of our listeners. It's hard going. We wish everybody a very, very nice week. And we'll see you next Monday.